Zoe George is this week's sportscaster on the line from Zoe's home. Kia ora, Zoe. Welcome back to Nights.
Hi, Brian. Always lovely to be on the show with you.
Always interesting to have you on, Zoe.
Would you like to start?
Well, let's begin with the first thing on your list, which is the collective agreements out very soon for New Zealand's top cricketers. I'm assuming it's men and women, and you were arguing, I think you might have already argued in an article and stuff, but it's time for Cricket New Zealand to actually address the gender pay cap or pay gap.
Yeah.
That's a bit Freudian from
me. Yeah, well, we're coming up to, so the collective negotiations are now complete between the New Zealand Cricket Players Association and New Zealand Cricket. And those contracts are due to be announced any day now. But I pose the question, Brian, what would you do if you were getting paid 88 to 100% less than your counterparts for doing the same job on the same day in the same conditions? And you had to hold down a second job to make ends meet. Would you stay? Would you go? Would you feel valued?
Oh, yeah. No, obviously, in that particular one. No, I would be rather disappointed if it was that much of a gap. Yes.
Yeah, so that at the moment is what our domestic women's cricketers are facing, particularly those who play T20. And they play T20 double headers on the same day as men, and they are earning between 88 and 100% less than the men in that kind of situation. So at the moment, base retainers for men are around about that 27,000 plus match fees for the domestic season, while women who sit outside the international White Fern setup and are considered amateurs receive about $3,250 worth of compensation and no match fees. Now, that was negotiated 3 years ago, and that's $3,250 more dollars than what women were getting before that. For the international teams, the White Ferns retainers have been between $44,000 and $64,000, while Black Caps retainers have previously started at around that $100,000 mark plus match fees. So I think, hopefully, now is the time for NZC to change its mindset in regards to women in cricket. Instead of thinking about women as a cost centre, thinking about them as an investment, because if we want to be the best in the world and if we want to have a sport that is for everyone, then they need to invest in women and girls in cricket. So hopefully we will see those base retainers equal and match fees equal. And yeah, I've got my fingers and toes crossed, and hopefully we'll hear about that in the next couple of days or weeks.
Now, your argument that we could see this as an investment in the women's game could be one of the counters to the argument that people will throw back at that, which is that look at the difference between the crowds that go to see the men play and the women, and that's where the money comes from. Maybe that's why you justify the gender gap.
Yeah, so I'm going to throw that right back at you and say that statistics released from the ICC show the 2022 World Cup, which was held here in New Zealand, the digital video content had 1.6 billion views and more than 104.8 million tuned into broadcast streams or on television. So people are watching women's cricket. They are engaging with women's cricket. And the media are also paying attention. Our Cricket World Cup content was incredibly popular, but not only that, while that tournament was on, it also boosted the coverage of all other women's sport. So it spiked to about 33% of all sports coverage. That's the coverage of all women's sport, including the Cricket World Cup, which is doubling the normal rate of coverage for women in sport, according to Sport New Zealand. And 7 out of the top 10 most mentioned players in the media during the Cricket World Cup were White Ferns, including Meili Kerr and Susie Bates. We are seeing more and more crowds coming into our venues. Obviously, COVID the last 2 years has been incredibly difficult. That Cricket World Cup final, it was a sellout. And once they lifted all of those, you know, COVID restrictions, the crowds came in. Going to the Basin Reserve, Brian, I don't know if you've been to a double header with the Blaze and the Firebirds. The crowds are amped, they're pumped, and it's almost 50-50 gender split as well. When you look around the crowd, there are both men and women cheering on the men's and women's teams. So people do care about women's sport, they do care about women's cricket, and now's the time to invest. But unfortunately, what happens when we've got underinvestment in something like cricket is that we have an underperformance at the top level. And that's what we saw happen at the Cricket World Cup. The White Ferns didn't make it to the semi-finals on home soil, and they got blamed. But they are a symptom of the wider culture. There is no clear pathway for women in sport between domestic to international. There's no A competition that men have where they get to go off and experience different environments and learn to adapt before they step up into the Black Caps, where they can test not only their physical skills but also their mental skills. And we are throwing in a whole bunch of new players into the White Ferns, who are off to the Commonwealth Games in a couple of weeks, who have had no international experience and no bridging gap. And so I do worry a little bit about that. We also don't have a pathway for development of women players to move on to something like coaching. We've got lots of men in coaching, and they've gone, and BJ Watling is a prime example. He's now going with the Wellington Firebirds after retiring last season. First year out of not playing, and he's in there. There is no pathway for women, and out of all the domestic teams, including women's teams and men's teams, we've only got one team that has one female coach, and to be quite honest, that's not good enough. Other sports are looking at pathways to give women more opportunities to step into coaching and step up into those positions. Rugby have started to do it. Rugby of all sports. Football are doing it. So if they can do it, why can't cricket? And so now is the time to really invest and go, yes, we believe in the future of cricket. We believe that women are the future of cricket, and now's the time to support them.
FINA, which is the governing body of swimming, was in the news recently. I had to, FINA stands for Fédération Internationale de Natation, which I assume is French for swimming.
Yes.
But... I mean, yes, that's not what we're talking, why we're talking about FINA. FINA got in the news because they made some calls about transgender inclusion, inclusion of transgender athletes in swimming sports. Just remind you of what those were, Zoe.
Yeah, so this is 2 weeks ago now. All of FINA's major associations came together in Budapest to hear about the proposed policy, which New Zealand did vote in favour for. More than 80% of their associations voted in favour, which pretty much bans transgender women from competing if they have experienced male puberty. Now, they have also said that they will consider an open category for transgender athletes. And off the back of their choice of their policy, a whole bunch of other sports have now said that they are going to either do the same. Rugby league has already banned transgender athletes until they believe more research is done to prove that it's safe for athletes in the women's game to play against trans athletes. We've also got the likes of netball, we've got athletics, we've got football, we've got triathlon, we've got badminton. So there's a whole raft of sports now coming out in the wake of the FINA decision talking about trans inclusion or exclusion in their sport.
What's Sport NZ doing? Anything?
So, yeah, now they've been working on their trans inclusion guiding principles for the last several years. And in the last couple of weeks, they've been having a consultation period where people within the sector have been able to give their feedback on the draft guidelines. Now, I've seen the draft guidelines, and they're approximately 30 pages long. They are incredibly dense. And so what's happening now is that during this consultation period, sports bodies now have up until, I think it's July 15, to give their feedback. Now, their guidelines are based around six different aspects, which include inclusion, well-being and safety, privacy and dignity, anti-discrimination, anti-bullying, anti-harassment, listening and responding, and education. The thing with the Sport New Zealand guidelines and the difference to what's going on internationally is that these guidelines are for community sport. And the vast majority of us, I mean like 99% of us, play at a community sport level. We don't play at an elite level where the likes of FINA and those governing bodies oversee that. Many of the sports that I've spoken to about what they're doing in regards to the guidelines here have talked about being sport for all and inclusion for all. So what happens with these guidelines is that once all the consultation's been done, they'll write them all up a bit better and then or properly, and then they'll release them at the end of the year. Now, sports bodies do not have to apply these guiding principles to their transgender policy if they so don't want to, but they are being encouraged to do so. I'm aware that New Zealand Rugby are currently working on their consultation period, and that's due to start really soon as well. But New Zealand Rugby came out a couple of weeks ago and said again that they want their sport to be inclusive and a sport for all. So, very interesting times.
Are we looking at community sport guidelines barring transgender athletes who've experienced male puberty? So we're not looking at that in this country?
No, there is no mention of anything like that within a community sport guidelines.
Okay.
The community sport guidelines is from what I'm reading, because I'm sitting here looking at it right now, it's about 30 pages long, is about inclusion and making sport accessible for everyone.
But what happens when we go on to representative level?
And so this is where the next level of discussions happen. So where do we apply our community guidelines to, and then where do we apply our international guidelines to? Where do they meet? And that's the question that I have been put to Swimming New Zealand over the last couple of weeks. 2 weeks ago, they told me that they were going to meet last week and tell us how they were going to apply it. They still haven't made a decision. I'm going to continue to ask them about where that cap is. One of the proposals from swimming and other sports is about having an open category. Now, for some sports that have a lower participant base, for the likes of New Zealand Rugby League, which I spoke to them about their trans inclusion policy as well, that is just not going to be possible because they do not have the player numbers. Having open category... It's a tough one. For example, the Southland Marathon, I think it was, recently had male-female open category, and it worked really, really well.
How many people do you know? How many people took part in the open category?
No, I need to follow that up and ask. But our Southland reporters did a great job talking about diversity in sport and why having an open category is for everyone, which is great. Unfortunately, at an elite level, if we look at an open category, which is just meant to be for transgender players, the reality is that there are not enough athletes at that level. So they're going to miss out for the time being. There's just not enough. With this discussion, I have received so many emails. I've been approached on social media asking my opinion on this subject. And one of the questions that I've been asked multiple times is, Zoe, how would you feel if the New Zealand women's rugby team, the Black Ferns team, were full of transgender women, preventing other women from taking their spots? And my response to them is that the chance of that happening is incredibly minute. If we look at the statistics, particularly in regards to our transgender and gender diverse population and our general population, about 1% of our general population are transgender or gender diverse. And we know from research out of the University of Waikato called Counting Ourselves, which is the biggest research into trans experience in New Zealand ever done, it says approximately 70% of our transgender and gender non-binary community will not participate or engage in sport because of discrimination.
Interesting point. I just want to, just somebody came through with a text now. And I think the text to represents a misunderstanding. If men are allowed in women's elite sports, women won't take part because they'll always lose against men. I don't understand why the men would want to compete against women. But the thing is that these people don't identify as men.
Yes.
They identify as transgender, and that's the difference.
Yes. And this is one of the things that we are seeing, particularly with those who don't acknowledge transgender women. There is a lot of language that's been used around them. And a lot of the work that is being done in this space, it's recognizing transgender women as women. These aren't men who identify as women. These are women. These are transgender women. And they want to be able to play in a sport that aligns with their identity, which is women's sport. And so this is where a lot of the discussion is around. We've also got trans men as well, don't forget, and gender non-binary. But a lot of these policies have been focusing on the inclusion of trans women in women's sport.
And I just wonder, another possibility, because this is, as you point out, people feel very strongly about this, Zoe. And here's another text saying, what about Lord Coe, Sebastian Coe, talking about fairness, and people pick up on this stuff. But I've also seen surveys of sports people in Australia which suggest that actually a majority of women are quite comfortable about this. Maybe the athletes should decide.
Yeah, well, this is right. There's not a lot from here, but the research out of Australia, UK and Canada show around about that 75 to 80% of women want transgender women in their sport. And I've spoken to so many athletes, female athletes, about this subject. I spoke to a wrestler the other day, actually, about it. And she's like, I am all down for it. It might bring more people to my sport. I may actually have competitors that I can wrestle against. She wrestles against men already because there aren't enough women for her to practice against. And this is one of the things within this whole discussion as well, is that there are so many other things that are going on in women's sport that particularly men are ignoring. And yet this is like the number one thing that they want to focus on. And with the FINA stuff, again, it was men making decisions about women and women's bodies. And some of the policies that are being brought in, some of the legislations that are being brought in or trying to be brought in, particularly in the United States, are incredibly toxic and damaging. In Ohio, not only is it damaging to transgender women, it's also damaging to women, because what they're proposing over there is that if you are a woman or girl or transgender woman or girl and you're playing women's sport, anyone in women's sport, you can have your gender questioned, and then you have to undergo sex testing. And in some cases, that sex testing involves invasive genital exams.
Right.
And we're talking about girls and women of all ages.
Of course, there are some women, prominent women, who've also spoken out against transgender. Mm. Martina Navratilova, well, she did. I don't know what her stance is now, but she was one, I mean, who of course was a trailblazer in her own way, coming out as lesbian as a professional tennis player, best part of 20 years ago, or was it longer now?
Yeah, it's been a wee while. Yes, she has come out and said that transgender women don't belong in women's sport. Yep. There's lots of people.
You haven't managed to speak to her yet. That'll be an interesting interview.
Yeah, no. I mean, we've talked about this subject a lot over the years, Brian. I've been covering this subject now for, gosh, about 5 or 6 years now, and I've spoken to lots of people on lots of different sides. It is incredibly complex, but I think for now, one of the things, core things that we need to focus on is a little bit of kindness, because there is not a lot of kindness, and some of the language that we're using is incredibly detrimental to people's health and well-being. Sport, at the end of the day, is a basic human right, according to the International Olympic Committee. Everyone deserves to play, participate, and engage with sport. And I think that's what we're going to see, particularly at a community level. That's what Sport New Zealand's indicating. That's what many of our sports are indicating. An inclusive environment where people feel welcome and safe to be able to play sport, because sport is for all and sport should be safe for all.
Zoe, it's always great having you on. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Always wonderful, Brian.
Zoe George back with more sport from her unique perspective. And always very well-voiced perspective in about 6 weeks from now.